Welcome to News Talk, and this is D.G. Martin, and my guest is a friend and a fellow friend of the University of North Carolina in Chapel Hill. Howard Covington is the author of numerous books. He's a former journalist, but right now he's written a book that that takes us back on the university and Chapel Hill to the time between World War I and the Great Depression. His new book, or his recent book, is Fire and Stone, The Making of the University of North Carolina Under Presidents Edward Kidder Graham and Henry Woodburn Chase. Howard Covington, thanks for coming to visit with us in Chapel Hill about your book about the history of Chapel Hill.
Glad to be here.
Tell us about Edward Kidder Graham and then about Henry Chase and where they fit in the history of our university.
Well, they were both, this is a period of writing about just before World War I when Graham was part of the faculty and became acting president of the university while his president, Francis Venable, actually took a year's sabbatical to get his nerves back in order after a very strenuous year. And then on through to the end of the 1920s and the tenure of Harry Chase, who succeeded Graham as president. Graham was a native of North Carolina from Charlotte, came from a family that was distinguished itself in the field of education. He had a sister who was president of Peace College. At that time, it was Peace Institute, I think, in Raleigh. His cousin was Frank Graham, whose father was a school superintendent in Charlotte. So there were plenty of educators in his background, but he was educated at UNC and really did not know another educational institution well beyond his own campus in Chapel Hill. He spent some time at Harvard and a little bit of time at Columbia in graduate study, but when he became president in 1914, he did not have his earned degree was a master's degree. He had been
Teaching English or history?
He was teaching English. He had been teaching English for about a decade on the Chapel Hill campus, and had developed a tremendous following. He was a young man in the midst of a whole faculty host of old men. And the young students, the students who were coming into the university in the first decade of the 20th century, just took to Graham immediately. He had a connection with them and believed in them as leaders. During his years, the student government got a revival and became a real force on campus. Students began policing themselves, and the student council would administer punishment and for violations of various infractions, and Graham supported them, and the administration did too. But he was in his mid-30s. He was early to mid-30s during these years and had a connection with them. And he delighted in having them in his class. He would send them out into the campus to write about what they saw and what they found. Frank Graham said he was the greatest teacher he had ever had.
Mm. Well, to connect it to present times, there are two connections, or maybe more, but two that come to my mind. One is that Edward Kidder Graham lived in a house near the campus called
Bull Rushes,
and that house has recently been reconstructed, and so it is a monument to him, as that was where he lived. The other is that the Graham Memorial Building, which is right with a large building near the wall and on Franklin Street, where people gather, is Graham Memorial. And that's not Frank Graham Memorial. That's Edward Kidder Graham Memorial. So those are, you know, we don't have memories of him, but those link us to the...
Bulrushes was a house he built. You got to remember, in Chapel Hill, when he was a faculty member in the early part of the century, faculty members had to find their own housing. I mean, well, they do today, of course, but I mean, Chapel Hill was a village. You didn't have any housing.
Or any condos.
Right. As a bachelor, Edward Kidder Graham was a tenant in that, what's the house there, directly across from the President's Mansion, the stucco.
Oh, is that? No, I missed that.
He was a tenant for the lawyer in a house that was near there, and the lawyer who was had his offices there. But he married Susan Moses, who came from another child of a family of educators, and they built this house, Bulrush. It's right there on the corner, just up the lane from Senlac, which was where
the big now
Battle's house was. He get too far ahead of the story, but he died in 1918 during the flu epidemic. And was always counted as a casualty of World War I because of that. His death at age 42 came as such a shock to not only the campus, but the state at large, because he had built a following across the state.
Howard, he was the guy who had this phrase that's kind of become the word that expands the university's borders all the way to the end. What was that phrase?
The boundary of the university is coterminous with the boundaries of the state. I never found that he actually said those very words, but it certainly he expressed that thought very often.
Coextensive was the word.
Coextensive, right. But he believed in the university being of service to the
Was that a new idea?
Yes. His predecessor, Venable, thought extension was a waste of time, that the university's responsibility was to its students who were on the campus and in the laboratories and in the classrooms. They shouldn't be out in public libraries and in public school rooms and messing around. And
that was diversionary from their main mission.
It was.
Yeah.
Venable didn't know how to get money, and he was husbanding all the resources he had.
What Venable, according to your book, identified Graham as a manager of student affairs and gave him increasing responsibilities.
He did.
And I guess recommended him to be the acting president while he was in Europe, or
Venable had this harrowing experience. A freshman died in a hazing incident on his second night on campus, and it created an uproar throughout the whole state. It was a terrible experience for Venable, who believed that the university was sort of the substitute parent for students attending, and he felt a personal responsibility for this boy's death. There was troubles continued throughout the year. He appointed Graham to sort of look after this investigation and make sure that the circumstances surrounding it were fully investigated, and that that hazing be washed from the campus again. They did this happen about every 20 years, and so he was sort of a dean of students, but it didn't have a dean of students at that time. But he was the dean of the school of basically liberal arts, and he was a secondary substitute president at times. You got to remember the president's office was one man, the president. He didn't have anybody working for him, not even a secretary. His secretary was a student volunteer. So he would have someone to come in to help him write some letters and do some things like that. But basically, this was added on to Venable's regular duties as a professor of chemistry. So he drew on Graham to help him through this year. By the end of the academic year in the spring of 1913, he was completely worn out and asked for a leave of absence. The trustees appointed Graham to be the acting president in his absence, with the understanding that Venable would come back and resume the office.
We'll, after the break, we'll take up what happened when Venable came back, or before he came back. But one of the interesting things in the early part of your book, as Venable is preparing to leave, he has one big task that he's not been able to complete, of a fundraising variety. And this struck me, given our recent encounter with the results of that successful fundraising. Talk about, and it sort, but kind of put in perspective about what life was like 100 years mm-hmm. ago in terms of our connection to the Confederate cause. And so what was on his shoulders that he couldn't succeed in, well, before he went to Europe?
The United Daughters of the Confederacy had wanted to erect a statue on the university campus, and that had been agreed to. They were responsible for raising the money to pay for this statue. The Confederacy, or the recent unpleasantness, the Confederacy was an everyday part of life. There was the William Kane, who was the head of the mathematics faculty on the campus, had been an officer in the Confederate service, and he was called Major Kane. He was called by his military title. There were members of the Board of Trustees who were referred to by their military service. The Secretary of State was the same thing. So the Civil War was over, but it wasn't gone. And this was at a time when there was a resurgence of appreciation by the United Daughters of the Confederacy and the Sons of Confederate Veterans and other organizations like that to memorialize the service of those in service to the lost cause. There were tablets in Memorial Auditorium listing the names of all those who had been killed in the war. So this was a very, very present kind of thing. One of the things that Graham did, which was quite remarkable considering all this fever for the South, was that he taught he would speak in his chapel appearances. Chapel was a required attendance. About not only the virtues of Robert E. Lee, who was held up as an icon for these Southern boys, but also that the South needed to be considered in the light of Abraham Lincoln as much as Robert E. Lee.
And that was controversial.
That was a revolutionary idea for these young men who had been taught that Lee was the devil and the cause of all the problems. Back to the story. I'm sorry, I got diverted. Venable is preparing to leave the campus for a year, traveling abroad to his old haunts where he was in school in Germany. And the UDC came up short on the money to pay the sculptor for Silent Sam, who was the sculptor was a was a Yankee, to put it in terms of the day. He had done other monuments and statues on monuments that were in one was in Bath, Maine, and there were others around up there. Some thought he may even have been a naturalized citizen and Canadian by birth. But comes up to the big day is coming. The sculpture is on its way. The statue is on its way. Venable doesn't have all the money he needs to pay the man for his work, so he took it out of his own pocket and paid the bill for the statue.
Well, it's interesting to look back 100 years ago to see what was going on in Chapel Hill then, and you're helping us with that as we talk about your book, Fire and Stone, The Making of the University of North Carolina Under the Presidency of Edward Kidder Graham and Harry Woodburn Chest. Howard Covington will be back after this short break. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. I'm visiting with Howard Covington. We're talking about his recent book, Fire and Stone. The subtitle is The Making of the University of North Carolina Under Presidents Edward Kidder Graham and Harry Woodburn Chase. We talked a little bit, Howard, about the times when Graham, when Edward Kidder Graham was president and was preparing to be president. How did he get to be selected? How did he become selected? Because he was the acting president while President Venable was taking his sabbatical year. But Venable never came back, really. Did. I mean, he never came back to the presidency.
While Venable was away, there were some of Graham's former students who had gone out into the world and established themselves in various professions and business, and some of them were even members of the Board of Trustees. You got to remember the Board of Trustees had 100 members at that time. And there began a sort of quiet letter-writing campaign among some of them who were interested, who had been impressed by what Graham had done during his year as acting president. He didn't just stay on the campus and keep the classes on time. Graham was out in the community and speaking and talking about the university and becoming something more of a figure in the state. So his students, his former students, began talking about him as a possible replacement. By the time Venable was on the ship heading home, there was quite a growth in the sentiment among the trustees and who
made the decision? I mean, who hires the president?
Well, the Board of Trustees hired the president directly, and by the time Venable was sort of landing and the ship was docking in New York City, even his friends were saying, you know, maybe it's time for you to go back into the classroom. That's where he was happiest. They too had seen what Graham could do for
them. Did Graham campaign for the job?
Not at all. This was all done among his friends or his former students, and there were people. He had some real champions. Josephus Daniels, for example, was an important figure among the trustees, and he was a big fan of Graham's. There were others who of that stature who were in his corner. So by the time the trustees met at commencement every year. So by the time graduation rolled around in June, the handwriting was on the wall, as they say, or on the blackboard for Venable.
How did they tell Graham that he was going to be president?
Well,
if he's not really campaigning for it.
In effect, Venable knew what was coming. He submitted his resignation. Huh. So then they had a meeting of the trustees during the week of graduation week and elected.
And there was no big search committee where they paid $100,000 to.
Nobody went searching. They just said, okay, the job's yours.
We got somebody who's good. He's done it, and he's. Well, this is interesting in terms of the selection process today, both for chancellor and mm-hmm. for president. Sometimes it goes via search committee, and sometimes it goes because we know who we want.
Mm-hmm.
So, as you mentioned in our first segment, Edward Kidder Graham unfortunately died early, only 3 years or so after he became president. So what did he get done while he was president?
Well, he came into office with some momentum. By the time classes started in the fall of 1913, he was ready to go, and you got to remember that at this point, the university was like an oversized Davidson College. It was a liberal arts college. Now, it had a law school, and it had a medical program, and it had a pharmacy school, and those things that you would find at a university. But by and large, young men, and mainly, there were mainly young men. There wasn't only young men, but by and large, mainly young. The student body was made up of about 700 or 800 men, and that's not a lot. That's not a big crowd. You had a few buildings clustered around South Building. There had only been one building built with public funds by the time when Graham took over as president. All the other buildings had been built by public by donation, by subscription or gifts to the to the trustees who use the money to the Carr Building, for example. Mm-hmm. Julian Carr paid for that. The Alumni Building was built by the alumni, so forth. Graham, there was another big change happening in the state, and that was the introduction of high school education, which started to spread in the first decade, largely because of work.
So before in 1900, it was a rarity for there to be a high school in one of the North Carolina communities.
I couldn't tell you exactly how many there were, but maybe no more than
In the big towns, there would be.
Well, even cities like Greensboro, Raleigh, Charlotte, they counted on public schools to educate kids.
What about for black students?
The first African American high school was opened in 1929, I think, in Greensboro. Dudley High School may have been
the highest level that a African American kid and many white kids as well could attain until the 1920s for most people was eighth to ninth grade.
If they went that far, yeah. And if you came from a family that had the money to pay for attendance at a prep school. Then you went to a preparatory school that led to examinations for admission to the university. But
so, what difference did that make? Both in terms of the early unavailability of public education for young pre-college students to its increasing availability.
Well, by the time Graham became president, there were more students. There were more potential university students in the pipeline. So every year, the enrollment of the university grew, and the enrollment was growing at what was then State College, or actually it was named something else, but what eventually became State College, NC State. So higher education was breaking out of its old past of just being a place to educate the elites, which was a complaint about the university. Graham was considered a big deal when Graham invited and encouraged the North Carolina Farmers Union to have a meeting on the Chapel Hill campus. Every year that the demographics of the student body were widely broadcast across the state, he made sure to let people know how many sons of farmers and sons of mechanics and sons of small business people, as well as the sons of doctors and lawyers and others who were more privileged, perhaps. But this was a small liberal arts college, and I compared it to Davidson because Davidson was a Presbyterian school. This was a Presbyterian school. There hadn't been any presidents of the university, save one, I think, since its founding, who wasn't a Presbyterian. So there's this influence there as well. Graham was gregarious. He was lively. He was imaginative. He was in a hurry, and he didn't waste time in his early years as president. He began. He had some real supporters on the campus too. Louis Round Wilson was behind the extension program, and that really took off in Graham's early years. And
then the. Real quickly, I guess we could spend all day talking about Edward Kidd, Eric Graham, but real quickly, early on, the World War One sort of took things over, and I was surprised at your description of how extensively the university changed from being the small liberal arts college to being a military academy. What happened?
What happened was the war and the demands of, the U.S. entered World War One in 1917. Leading up to that in 1916, young men were beginning to volunteer for the. There was a buildup of the armed forces. There were Americans heading to Europe to serve there, but by the time when the U.S. entered the war, the first draft registration occurred on graduation day in 1917. So there was a big parade down Franklin Street to honor all these young men signing up for the draft. Everybody who signed up for the draft, and most of these men were signing up for the draft, were all college age. So colleges and universities around the country who depended primarily on tuition for their income, all of a sudden saw their registrations plummet. And the future, the economic future of institutions like the university was really in jeopardy. So what Woodrow Wilson did, and the Congress did, was in a way to help salvage, to keep the institutions alive so they didn't go into bankruptcy, was turn college and university campuses into military installations. So in the spring of, this began to come together in the summer of 1917, and by September of 1918, the university became part of the Student Army Training Corps and was literally under the command of a U.S. Army officer. So
the Army, rather than Edward Kidder Graham, ran the campus.
Graham was relieved, was not relieved as president. He just wasn't president any longer. And he actually had a job as supervising the SATC program throughout the southeastern United States. So he was the one who college presidents, the small schools, would call and say, oh, please, please help me, let me enroll. You had to have at least 100 able-bodied men in your student body to qualify for SATC. So some schools, like Elon College over here, I think they stretched the limits a little bit so they could qualify. But all of the curriculum has changed. The faculty members had to restructure their courses. The government was concerned that the men who were being drafted and coming into the military had no idea what this war was about. So there were courses in American history, in European history, in politics, and in government to try to educate these soldiers onto what they were getting ready to go give their lives for.
Well, if you joined us late, I'm visiting with Howard Covington about his recent book, Fire and Stone. He and I will be right back. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin, and my guest is Howard Covington, author of a new book, Fire and Stone, subtitled is The Making of the University of North Carolina under Presidents Edward Kidder Graham and Harry Woodburn Chase. And we talked a lot about Edward Kidder Graham, not enough, but one of the unsung heroes of the university, when you read Howard Covington's book, you'll realize, is Harry Chase. And tell us a little bit about Harry Chase, because there's no buildings for him, no monuments for him. Who was he?
Chase was a faculty member who had been drafted into the administration with the death of first Graham from the flu, and then his immediate successor, Marvin Stacey, died of the flu 60 days later. Chase was elected president in the summer of 1919, almost as a placeholder. The leading candidates were disqualified on the eve of the election because of a ruling by the Attorney General who said you couldn't elect a trustee as president. So Chase had a reputation as a strong faculty member, and they figured, well, he'll be there for a year and then go on. He was a relatively young man in his 30s. He ended up staying for 10 years and totally transformed the university. It became a university in not just in name, but in fact, under Chase. As I said earlier, UNC was basically a small liberal arts college when as Granite Graham. And Chase found it that way when he came, took over. But he began building the graduate school. He began improving the faculty, hiring faculty members who had PhDs. Throughout his time, Chase's time in the School of Education, it was chaired by a man who didn't even have a college degree, but who had a strong reputation in education. The enrollment during the 20s, during Chase's years, tripled. So did the headcount of the faculty. The graduate school was created. The business school was created. The law school achieved national recognition and accreditation. When Chase arrived, admission in the law school didn't require a college degree. That changed. He expanded the entire footprint of the campus. The boundary of the campus was really South Building. Everything down the hill between South Building, what's now Wilson Library, was rough woods. There were few latrine or bathrooms, restrooms in the old dorms, and if a man was in a hurry in the morning, he just hit it down the hill, and that was that became the new campus. All those buildings, Saunders Building, Manning, where the law school is, and eventually the library built at the end of.
Where did the money come from to do this?
There was an uprising of citizen movement in 1921 that convinced the legislature to approve $5 million in expenditures, not only for UNC but for other institutions, other universities and mental health institutions. It was not what they needed, but it was enough to build eight dormitories,
It was a lot.
Nine new dormitories altogether, including one for women. Spencer Dormitory on Franklin Street was opened in 1925-26 to house women. Otherwise, women students at the university had to find a room in town where they lived during the school year. A new football stadium was built. Keenan Stadium opened in 1926 or 27. That was from private money, but the UNC Press was created during this time. You get the idea of this was a time of a great change of momentum and
and
innovation.
Really important. I want to take a break and then come back, and I want to talk about some of the controversies that Chase had to face. If you join us late, I'm visiting with Howard Covington about his book, Fire and Stone. He and I'll be right back. Welcome back to Who's Talking. If you join us late, I'm visiting with Howard Covington. He's talking about a remarkable book, Fire and Stone. It's about the subtitle is The Making of the University of North Carolina under Edward Kidder Graham and Harry Woodburn Chase. We talked about Chase, really a remarkable person, and I've already apologized to you off the record for not giving you more time to talk to him, about this remarkable man. One of the most interesting parts of your book are the controversies that developed between the university and the more conservative business and religious groups that were very important during the 1920s. Tell us about first the controversy about teaching evolution in the university.
Well, there was a bill introduced in the General Assembly in 1925 that would have prohibited Darwin's theory of evolution being included in the public school curriculum. It was sort of discounted at first, but Chase got word from friends in Raleigh, said, pay attention, this is serious. And indeed, it did turn out to be serious and became quite an issue in the midst of of that session. Chase, the faculty was aroused here and elsewhere, but not quite. But Chase used very good judgment in keeping his people on campus and saying, if they need a goat, I'm going to go to Raleigh, I will be the sacrificial goat.
I cannot help but, we still know who Collier Cobb was.
Right.
And or we know the name, Collier Cobb. And so Collier Cobb taught geology or something, mm-hmm. but he was teaching evolution and very proud of it and wrote a book. But that doesn't seem controversial to us at all right now, but it was
very
fire.
Controversial.
President Chase said, you can't go, Collier Cobb.
Right. Cobb wanted to go over there
and teach them and instruct them.
But Chase was smart. He did not, instead of turning the argument into a debate over whether Darwin was right or not, he made the whole issue turn on the question of intellectual freedom. He said, for example, the legislature wouldn't dare tell a preacher what to say from his pulpit, so it has no more right to say what a teacher can say in his or her classroom. The Constitution, this is a quote from that hearing, the Constitution did not promise this liberty to everybody but school teachers. It promised that the liberty of speech in the press shall not be abridged. And he made that issue within the legislature, and it resonated with some serious people. The bill actually was defeated in the committee, but a minority report made its way to the floor of the legislature, and there was a great debate that went on for a couple of days before it was finally resolved. Chase endured heaps of praise. Of criticism, not as much praise, but it did eventually come his way. But in the heat of it all, one Baptist minister in Charlotte, at First Baptist Church in Charlotte, although the Presbyterians were hard on this issue too, but it was a Baptist church in Charlotte whose preacher not only filled his sanctuary with listeners on a Sunday evening, but then broadcast his sermon condemning Chase in the university to about 30,000 listeners around the city of Charlotte. But Chase withstood all of this and defended his position and the university's position repeatedly. And essayist Gerald Johnson was attributed to him the statement that if the university doesn't stand for anything but appropriations, Chase had been asked if he worried that the legislature would have some retribution because of his opposition to this bill. He said, if the university doesn't stand for anything but appropriations, I, for one, don't care to be connected with it. Now, Johnson published that in a profile, an essay he wrote about Chase many years later. I was never able to find that exact quote, but again, like the Graham quote, he certainly expressed that attitude in explaining in the chapel services, chapel meetings on campus and elsewhere, that he believed in the university and that this was a direct attack on the university's very existence if this was allowed to succeed.
Well, you've even in the little time that I've given you, you've persuaded us that Harry Chase was a very important and successful president. Why did he leave?
Why did he leave? The Depression. The Depression came early to North Carolina, and the budget at the university got cut year after year after year, beginning in about 1927, more in 29. There were greater cuts forecast in 31. Chase was a relatively young man in his early 40s. And he had an offer to go to the presidency of the University of Illinois, which was a much larger institution, higher profile, much higher pay. He was there for a few years. Unfortunately for him, there was a turnover in the political control in the state of Illinois. And he had been hired by the Republicans. The Democrats came in and made life hell for him, so he decided. When he got an offer to go to New York City as president of New York University, that he had had it with public institutions and went and spent the balance of his career at NYU, which was a privately funded school.
We're at the end of our time, but just one more question. And with all that Chase did for the university, why isn't he more remembered? We've got Graham buildings. The chancellors and presidents generally have markers, but I don't know.
Well, he left in the Depression. There wasn't any money to honor honor Chase with a building. It had taken him 10 years to get Graham Memorial built to honor Edward Kidder Graham. Frank Graham came in. He was in office for, 17, 18 years. By that time, Chase was a memory, and there weren't any Chase advocates running around Chapel Hill saying we.
Well, you've left a monument for him in your wonderful book, and there'll be more attention to him and appreciation, at least in leadership, because of what you've done, and we're thankful to you for telling us about him.
Enjoyed it.
Our guest has been Howard Covington, author of Fire in the Stone. Thanks to him for being with us and also for his new book. Thanks to you for listening. It's D.G. Martin who's talking, and I'll be back here before you know it.